Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 107 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. One of the things I love about studying the Middle Ages is reading sources that give us a glimpse into the culture of the time. Sometimes the lessons we're meant to learn are set out for us explicitly by the authors. Medieval people left us all sorts of instruction books. And sometimes we can learn a whole lot by reading between the lines. Often, I find that there are many ways in which, whether we like to admit it or not, we have continued traditions and lines of thinking straight from the Middle Ages and the ancient world, both for better and for worse. A book that encapsulates all of this, from the good to the bad to the ugly, is The Art of Courtly Love, or just On Love, by Andreas Capellanus. In it, we find the rules for courtly love affairs, at least from one perspective, in all their classic and cringeworthy glory. This week, I invited Peter Konieczny from Medievalist.net to help me dig into this fascinating book. So without further ado, here's our conversation on the art of courtly love and why it's time we let go of this outdated dating advice. Hi, Peter, and welcome to this episode where we're talking about the art of courtly love. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Hey, yeah. Getting ready to talk about the ultimate bro guide.
Right? I know. This is such a great source because to me, it's like by turns hilarious and infuriating at the same time. I think we should start at the beginning, though. So courtly love is a tradition that is said to have started in the southern part of France, Aquitaine especially, started by Eleanor of Aquitaine's grandpa. I think William started that troubadour poetry style where the ultimate form of love, at least romantic love, is adulterous. And it's between noble people and it's quiet, but that's what makes it great. And that's what we see kind of filtering on into like Arthurian legend and stuff. So when we talk about courtly love, that's what we're talking about. This book, The Art of Courtly Love, was written by a guy called Andreas Capellanus. So Andreas the chaplain. So it's written by a priest who apparently it seems to have worked in the court of Marie of Champagne, who was Eleanor of Aquitaine's daughter with her first husband, Louis. I think that's all the background we need for this. What do you think, Peter?
Yeah, he's not much of a chaplain.
Anyway. No, he's really not. But that is pretty much all we know about Andreas. This is the only book of his that exists, although I'm reading the Norton version. The translation is by John J. Perry, and he mentions at the beginning that there are a few charters that were signed by Andreas as well as Marie of Champagne. So he's like, he appears, but he hasn't written anything significant otherwise.
At least we know he was around, that they actually knew each other in the court. He was just one of the courtiers. Chaplain, I guess he had needed some sort of title.
Yeah, he says he's a chaplain, but like you say, he's not very good. Okay, so Peter, you're calling this the ultimate bro guide. Why do you call it the ultimate bro guide?
You know, it's something that I think my friends and I would be saying the kind of same stuff when we were younger.
Gosh, I hope you've evolved since then, man.
I think, yes, I have. But like, it's like, yeah, if you kind of imagine that bro culture and teenage hormones and college life, I guess, that kind of thinking, that's just meshed in here. And it's very much, you know, hey, we're men. How should we deal with women, if at all? With a bit of the kind of like, oh, and they're also here are women's views. Which I think come up a bit in like these court cases of the courtly love, but yeah, it's the strangest book because I don't know what to make of it. I don't know if it's satire or it's real, and that's being a big debate. Like, how much should we believe this? Because is this kind of like a fun take on courtly love, or is this guy serious? Are these rules serious?
Yeah, it's hard to know. There are things in this book that. Well, I guess I should explain the layout. So he tells you a little bit about love. Then he goes through these dialogues between people, men and women, and how they might potentially get together, get it on, fall in love. Although the sexual aspect is a pretty big deal in this. And then he's got a third part where he says, love is terrible. Just be a good Christian instead and don't fornicate. It's bad. So that's how he lays it out.
It's also, in a way, it's written to a guy named Walter, which we know nothing about, but he's probably like a young knight. I kind of just imagine this is just a fictional character, right?
It sounds like won't be it.
And that, like, this is my advice to you. And he starts going on. It's very kind of like choppy, right? It goes from one section to the other. And it's weird. Like, I don't think it's the greatest work of literature, put it that way.
No, it's not the greatest work of literature. Okay, so I'm going to get down into the nitty-gritty a little bit. So at the beginning, he talks about who is eligible to be a lover. And so, like, this is one of the sections that I think is kind of hilarious because as a chaplain, he might not have had, like, a wide range of experience. So, for example, he says, well, love suffering, right at the beginning, comes from overthinking, which I think is fair. But he says, people who are eligible to be lovers, it has to be hetero because how would gay sex even work? Obviously, yeah. It doesn't work. Oh, he also says you can't be poor if you want to be in love because you're thinking way too much about how you're going to put food on the table. So you can't be poor. Later on, he says that like peasants can't be in love because they're not sophisticated enough. Like what goes on between the beasts in the field, that's good enough for them.
Yeah. Can't be blind.
You can't be blind. That's the next one because love comes through the eyes. So you can't be a lover if you're blind unless you found love before you were blind. And then if you were made blind afterward, that's all right. So like this, it's obviously ridiculous.
There's age limits too.
Age limits. That was my next point. So there's age limits. You have to be above 12 if you're a girl. You have to be above 14 if you're a boy. But if you are between 14 and 18, as a boy, it's kind of a write-off because you just get embarrassed too easily and you're too changeable. You know, and I think that's kind of fair when you look at Romeo, right?
That's so true for like now. It's funny how many things, some observations are pretty dead on, you know, so.
Well, you might not like this part then because it says that, you know, after 60, it's no good for men. You're not 60 yet, but you know. That's where the cutoff is. And for women, it's 50. You can't be a lover after that. It's just not possible.
So I think I have more years on you than you. Just you saying. <too.
laughs> Well, yeah, but I'm younger than you. So we're good. So obviously all of these things are pretty absurd. And that's the part that I think is hilarious. Also, there are 5 ways that you can acquire love. The first one is to have a beautiful figure. That's always good.
Yeah, yes.
Second one is to have excellence of character. And he actually relies on this a lot, saying you could look however you look. Mm-hmm. It's your character that counts. But he also is real snob about nobility. The third one is extreme readiness of speech. And I think this just means kind of cleverness.
Yeah.
The fourth is great wealth. That can make you fall in love.
Yeah, that's happened before. It happens.
But you can't be greedy. He gets at that elsewhere. You can't be greedy. But great wealth is a reason to fall in love. And also the readiness with which one grants what is sought, which is, I think, pretty clear what he's talking about. The readiness with which one grants what is sought. So that's another reason to fall in love. So this kind of stuff is hilarious, but it also, I think, gets at cultural values, you know, and cultural ideas. Like Andreas has no idea about actual people in love. It's a very elevated, separated from reality type idea he's got here.
To me, it comes across as like if he kind of was talking with the guys and the guys are throwing out like you know, the knights and stuff, like let's throw out all our stuff at him. I'm not sure he's not like totally without love. He almost got that nun.
Yeah, there's a section where he's like, I almost got it on with a nun.
Yes. And he does make it clear that clerics, while they shouldn't have lovers, it happens. It's like he says, oh, but we know that no man can, like, you know, deal with that. Like, it was very rare. So, you know, it just happens anyway. So, and of course, with the nuns, but nuns should definitely not be lovers or things like that. But a chaplain? You definitely not, but if you do, you should just be as according to the rank of your parents.
Yeah, he's saying like clergy should not have sex, but if they do have it, they're great at it. They're just great at it because they know so much about the world. It's like, well, Andreas, you're not making a good case for it here. Yeah, those dialogues in the middle are between people of the same class or people of different classes. And I gotta say, Peter, they make me absolutely bonkers because it's like something from a really bad romantic comedy or like the incel playbook, like the involuntary celibate playbook. Because whatever the woman says, he says, "You don't understand," or he doesn't take no for an answer. Like, there are several points where the women are like, "I'm just not interested. So I hope that you find what you're looking for." And they're like, "Thank you so much, because I'm looking for you. And you're saying this really just makes me more devoted."
Oh my gosh. I think in every version is pretty much like, you're saying no, but there's hope, right?
Yeah. There's always this hope, which is just so toxic and horrible. It's bad.
Yeah, it is very interesting. Like, and it's all the nobleman with the slightly less noble woman, the woman with the slightly less noble man. Like, how did everyone, all these little interactions, and there's all these long speeches, right?
Yeah, well, that's typical for a medieval source. Yeah. Well, there is one time where it was the nobleman and the middle class woman, so like a tradeswoman or from a trades family. And what was he saying in that one? He was saying, "You are totally free to not love me if you don't want to. But if you don't give me this hope of love, it's legitimately homicide. You're killing me. I'm going to die from love if you don't agree to this." And she's like, "Well, I'm actually free to love whoever I want." And he's like, "That's true, but know that I'm going to die." I would like to say that these things are not part of our culture anymore, but you still see them popping up, and it goes way back to this and even further to Ovid.
Yeah. I can see these conversations happening now. Like, it's not something that, like, oh my gosh. Like, and maybe in part is like, this book has been so influential on like ideas of love and sex and things like that, that people still carry this kind of ideas forth, right? There's a section like just past that, like you're talking about other situations, like men, should you go after women that just want something, want gifts or money? And like, he says, no, definitely don't do it. They're just like prostitutes. And that, I think, would be something like teenagers would say, or young men would say to each other, right? Don't date her. She just wants your stuff.
The idea of a gold digger, right?
Yeah.
Andreas kind of gets at the fact that it could go the other way, but usually in his view, it's the women that are the gold diggers. There's a whole section at the end where he's like, well, the section where he's saying love is bad, and he just trashes women for pages and pages and pages and pages.
Yeah, like he lists them all these terrible things, you know, and then he spends like a few paragraphs on each one of these terrible things just to, you know, that's where we don't see, is that so satirical, right? Because he's also writing for Marie, a lady, right? Like, this is supposedly a text that's been commissioned.
Well, we don't know if it's been commissioned. He talks about Marie, he talks about Eleanor of Aquitaine in this and their decisions in the court of love, because he puts forward some court cases. How should we judge these lovers? But I'm not sure it's written for Marie. That's not totally clear. It seems almost like backpedaling, because he's put so much effort into talking about how to be a lover. And really, fornication is a sin. Yes. And he's supposed to be a chaplain. So that whole third section is all that very typical medieval Christian idea of how women are bad, how fornication is bad, and that. So I'm not sure that it's satirical, actually. Yeah. Seems pretty straightforward to me.
Like there's stuff, like he says, like, you know, your friendships with your other men, your male friendships will suffer. That's the, you know, bros before, you know. Yeah. And he seems to be flipping back and forth between, like, this should be emulated, or this is real, and this is what you should do, and then, like, don't do it.
Yeah, there's a push and pull, definitely, in this, especially because at the beginning he makes these arguments, like, love actually makes people good. It makes people do great things, and he often says within this, like, no good things are done. No one does any actions except for the sake of love, which is, again, kind of like where people are only doing things in order to get a reward for it. I do want to come back to that in a second. But he does say that having a lover, an adulterous lover, makes you chaste in a way, he argues, because it means you don't play the field. You're so in love, you're just sticking with one person. So actually, that's pretty good.
He does put a lot of importance on just having being with one person. And married love is not that, right?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. He actually lists marriage as one of the things that will kill love. So like there's a section called like things that will kill love, basically. And marriage is one of those things.
But it was also like you spend too much time together, that will kill love.
Mm-hmm.
If one person gets poor, you know, that will kill love too.
Yeah. Well, the things that I find disturbing about it are the things that are still around right now. Like these ideas of the things that make you increase love are absence. It makes the heart grow fonder, but also jealousy and envy. These things will make your love stronger. And one of the things that you should do if you're testing your lover is to make them jealous, because if they get jealous, then you know that it's true love. And if they're not jealous, well, obviously they're not that into you.
Well, I've heard it said that like the Middle Ages, people weren't emotionally mature.
Oh, and that's a book not like fair.
but a book like this, you know, geez, it just kind of writes into that, right? Because it does seem like that these are people that really can't control their libidos or emotions or know what they're doing or have a straight mind into these things, right?
Yeah. Although that's like saying that people in this century are the same way because you've read a book by a pickup artist, you know?
Yeah, it's exactly.
You can't base it based on like one person's. I mean, like, you can't see Peter is laughing really hard at this, but I think it's equivalent. No, it's equivalent though, because he's trying to tell people how to get it on. It is a pickup artist book from the Middle Ages, which is kind of weird, especially
written by a chaplain who at the end says, don't do it.
Yeah.
Well, but yes, it makes it a fun read, that's for sure.
Well, coming back to the pickup artist thing for a second, one of the things that is kind of disturbing in this book, it's like real theme. It's a very medieval thing, but it still exists in our culture. And Eleanor Yanig has talked about this quite a lot on her blog, Going Medieval, and probably on the many podcasts that she's visited since visiting ours. But she talks about this idea of love and sex being transactional. Right. So like, if I do these things, then therefore you must give your love to me. It only makes sense. So there's a lot of things where the men in this text are saying, if I do these things, then you are going to love me. You said you're going to, it's fine. And they make arguments like, well, you're not in a relationship right now, or you don't have a lover on the side. So therefore you should be with me. And a lot of these arguments are still around, actually in a creepy way. Well, no, it's always creepy. Let me just say that for the record. This is always a bad idea, thinking of love and sex as transactional. But it's actually pretty disturbing to know that these things haven't changed all that much since the Middle Ages. And again, before that, because much of Andreas's arguments are based on Ovid, at least in the notes that I've seen. So what do you think, Peter, about this idea of a transaction? Like a man has to perform these actions in order to be deserving of love, but also in order to have earned it. Like it's something that he's earned, that's something that must be given to him in fairness.
Yeah, I think in a way this is much of a rule book, right? And this is him saying, if you play by these rules, you will get love. Because he's also saying, like, you don't do it with money, you know, like prostitution. Like that's one thing he says, like, prostitution, no, I'm not even going to tell you how to do it. He is trying to give men guidelines on how to do it, that, and you will be successful. So, like, I can see, like, yeah, and, like, that's the only way he kind of can think, right? You know, I said, like, this is not an emotionally mature. This is getting what you want.
Yeah, it's a guide to getting what you want. And I wish that, like, again, I wish that we had come further than that, but we have not. One of the interesting arguments that Andreas makes is that there is this woman, I can't remember which dialogue it's in, but I think it's nobles. And the woman keeps saying, no, I know that love is bad. It makes you feel bad. I don't want to feel bad. So I don't want to take on a lover. And he's The man is like, let me tell you that if you don't take on a lover, you're gonna be in for some serious torment. And it's a real like heaven and hell thing. Do you remember this? He talks about a vision in which he's traveling in the forest and he sees all these women going by horseback, and some are in like really good shape. They look great, they're on great horses. And the ones behind that are being pestered all of the time. And then the ones behind that are like in rags and their horses are bad. And it turns out that the people who are in the front of the line on the great horses that are well-equipped are the people who have been lovers. And the people in the back are the people who have never given their love in life. And so it's like this idea of like the woman that this guy talks to at the back of the line in rags, she says, we're the dead. So there's this idea that after life, you're going to go to a sort of lover's hell. And this is how the man is trying to convince this woman to get it on with him, is like, if you don't do this, the afterlife is going to suck for you.
Yeah. It's a kind of an interesting version of a better to have loved and lost than have never loved before, right? But, and I think it reflects the kind of, you know, these conversations reflect the debates. I think medieval people then had about love and sex, all of which flows through the ideas like there's church regulations which may or may not apply or may or may not be right, but it also falls into that. So it's interesting. I think in many ways he's trying to show the debates that people have about what to do with love.
It's like Tina Turner, right? What's love got to do with it? Well, in this vision, when the god of love is leading this procession of people, the man who's dreaming this vision, he speaks to the god of love, and the god of love gives him 12 rules. Are you ready for this? So the 12 rules of love. Thou shalt, I love this, is like constructed like the 10 commandments. Thou shalt avoid avarice like the deadly pestilence and shalt embrace its opposite. So don't be greedy. That's bad. 2. Thou shalt keep thyself chaste for the sake of her whom thou lovest. So no booty on the side. 3, thou shalt not knowingly strive to break up a correct love affair that someone else is engaged in. So no snitching. No snitching. Because these are, again, these are supposed to be adulterous affairs and they're supposed to be quiet. And if anyone finds out, that's one of the love killers as well. 4, thou shalt not choose for thy love anyone whom a natural sense of shame forbids thee to marry. So stick to your own class. There's a lot of this in here. And there's a lot where Andreas is talking about how people being in different classes, the natural order of things, but we can get back to that maybe after. 5, be mindful completely to avoid falsehood. So no lying.
Yeah, that seems good advice.
Seems like good advice, but it seems almost off base with the way he's trying to kind of trick these women anyway. 6, thou shalt not have many who know of thy love affair. So I guess like a few people should know so that it's got legitimacy, but not a lot of people. 7, being obedient in all things to the commands of ladies, thou shalt ever strive to ally thyself to the service of love. So this comes to the idea of chivalry, where like you are the servant of ladies and you must do what ladies say. 8, in giving and receiving love solaces, or solaces, I should say, let modesty be ever present. Be modest, be humble. 9, thou shalt speak no evil. So there you go, don't badmouth people. 10, this is reemphasizing, thou shalt not be a revealer of love affairs. Like, seriously, don't snitch. 11, thou shalt be in all things polite and courteous. So again, this is chivalry. I guess we should talk about chivalry in a second. 12, in practicing the solaces of love, thou shalt not exceed the desires of thy lover. That's kind of a good one.
Yeah. Look, I can see this being given out like 20 years ago. I'd say, my friends, like, most of these rules, hey, those are things you should follow to.
I think I'd like a time machine to talk to Peter a few years ago. The chivalry thing is important, though. I guess we should talk about that. Whereas people often talk about chivalry as if there are set rules. Like, there's a code of chivalry and it's set and everyone follows that. And so it's worth mentioning that there is no code of chivalry. There's no like 10 commandments of chivalry that everyone follows.
Yeah.
That's a really flexible idea, but it is based on similar things like being in the service of ladies, being respectful and courteous, that kind of thing.
Yeah, there are several kind of guides about how a knight should behave in the Middle Ages. And that's kind of chivalry, but that's most of these guides are about how much of a ransom should you take from a person, right? It's more like, much more like, you know, deals with the military aspect, not much with social life.
Yeah.
Of, you know, chivalry.
Exactly. That's worth mentioning, is that chivalry is meant to be aimed at a military elite. It's not necessarily equivalent with courtly love. Good point, Peter.
But there's also this other list of 31 rules, which is, again, some of the similar kind of stuff. Don't make your relationships public. I think the first one, marriage is no real excuse for not loving.
Yes. And this doesn't mean like love within your marriage. It means love outside of your marriage. Yes. Just to be clear.
The one that I like the most is love can deny nothing to love.
Aww. Aww. Peter's a serious romantic, everybody. He's big into Valentine's Day. There are a few other things that are kind of crossovers with chivalry as well, where it's saying that you can't be a good lover if you are not generous to the poor. And one of the things that kills love is not being a Catholic anymore. So the idea of religion and generosity, these are all kind of intertwined as well.
Yeah, I think he's trying to like behave as a good medieval Christian would is very important. And I'm not surprised on that. If a chaplain's going to say that, like, yeah, there's some Christianity in this.
Yeah, it's one of these tricky things where I think a lot of people ask the question where how can we romanticize these adulterous affairs when we know that adultery is a bad thing? I mean, it's one of the Ten Commandments. You shouldn't be doing that. So how are we okay with this? Well, it sort of balances out where you can be a good person and definitely a good Christian, and that will make it okay.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine like this is an issue for people that in that kind of class who have to marry for political reasons. They would probably think, yeah, I need love too, right? But I'm not going to get that because my husband has to go on crusade and he's gone for like 3 or 4 years, or I never met this person before I got married. Like, they're probably, you know, wondering, what do I do? So
when you mention that, I think about aristocratic marriages where often an older man will take a second wife who's quite a lot younger for the sake of having children, having heirs. And one of the arguments in here is between a man and a woman, and the woman actually says, I'm pretty young and it grosses me out the idea of being with an older man. And he's like, well, you're wrong about that because my age makes me super wise and I've done all these great deeds and a younger guy hasn't had time to do all these great deeds. And he's like, one of my favorite things that he says is that, like, we see a lot of people who are older that have white hair, but also young people that have white hair and older people that have dark hair. So you shouldn't judge people by their hair. It's kind of funny where I guess what I'm saying is that you kind of imagine, or I kind of imagine, this mismatch in aristocratic marriages where the age gap is a problem. And then here somebody is actually seeking out a lover who is actually much younger than they are. That's a weird dynamic that I think I don't normally expect, perhaps.
It certainly plays to the idea that the men here are kind of looking for anything. They're trying not to be picky, but as long as they can find someone that's seen of success. It's funny because, like, you know, there's stuff like, you know, you shouldn't buy love, right? But then you should use your wealth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's like, in a sense, this rule book where even Andreas doesn't know the rules. I can almost see like a whole bunch of guys having this chat and like Andreas is like taking notes.
I think he probably is a player in the game as well.
Yeah.
Talking about Andreas, this was actually an article that I did a long time ago. It's been one of the most popular articles I've ever written. Actually, it appears in my first book, which is like how to tell if your 12th century lover is just not that into you. And he does like get at some of these things, which are pretty true today. Like, I don't agree with many of Andreas's ideas about transactional stuff and all that, but some of his observations about human nature are true, where it's like, if your lover doesn't, they're not as enthusiastic anymore in their solaces, or they're avoiding your messenger, or they're making themselves a little too pretty, they're probably not into you anymore. I think that's kind of fair. You know, if you're avoiding someone's messenger, you probably don't want to talk to them.
It is a complex world. People don't ask each other, are you in love with me? Do you really love me? You know, it's, you know, can we be a couple? No, you know, it's all just, let me send my servant with this flower. And if you clip the second petal off the flower, I know that you love me. That, and they have all these court cases, too, where the various countesses and queens get to decide on who was right and who was wrong in this matter.
Yeah. Is there one that jumps out at you? You're thinking about it.
There's the one between like an older man and a younger man both want the same woman, and who should get her. And
what's the conclusion?
I believe, if I remember right, it shouldn't necessarily be the younger man. Like, because the younger man argues, because I'm, you know, younger and stronger and more virile, it should be me. And the countess responds, oh, no, not really. That doesn't matter. So, as an older man, maybe, all right, I feel like I've got a shot.
Well, both answers are wrong because it's whoever she likes. It's whoever she wants to be with. That's what counts.
There's a good one about a lady who hasn't heard from her former lover for like 2 years. And because there's a rule that if your lover's been dead for 2 years, then you can take a new one. And she said, Well, I haven't heard from him. He's been gone. I haven't gotten any messages. So I should be able to take a new one. And they say, no. Your lover may be on an important quest. He can't communicate with you. He just can't reveal those details. Or the messenger has been killed on the way back. So you can't, you have to keep waiting until you hear definitively he's dead.
Yeah, well, that's a fair question because, you know, people are traveling and you don't necessarily know where they are. You can't say, like, find a friend on your phone and figure out where they are. So it is a legitimate question, people disappearing and not hearing from them for a while.
Do we think that this is anytime true? What? Like any of these court cases, are they reflective of things that actually happen? Because that's another debate. Like, it's courts of love.
That's hard to say. I mean, because all of these things are potentially true, like potentially viable. They're hypothetical situations. It could very well be based on somebody that they know. Although that would be kind of cheeky because they're not supposed to reveal any of these love affairs that they know about them.
That's true. These things aren't to be in public. But then we have a court of women. And I think in one case, she brings like 60 women to decide about the details of this case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's in that weird medieval space where women are ostensibly on a pedestal. They are meant to be obeyed. You're meant to be their servant. But at the same time, they're horrible. They have every fault in spades. So it's that weird space where you have these women who seem to be the only people who have any authority when it comes to love. At the same time, they should be always ignored because they're just terrible humans. Inferior in every way.
And that's what makes this book such a weird, weird read, right? He gives us every opinion. Oh.
Yeah. So in conclusion, my thoughts on this in conclusion, this is a book that tells you kind of a lot about medieval culture and their values in ways that are both, I think, a bit hilarious because of Andreas's innocence and his ridiculous prejudices. But it's also a little bit disturbing that people think we've evolved, and actually many of the cultural things that we fall back on when it comes to love that we see in our culture are kind of stuck in the past. So maybe we need to look at this as a way to see where maybe we can improve from here. But again, it's a really interesting book because it has all of these things in it.
And I would just say, don't give this to your teenage boy to read. Wait till he's older.
And wiser, like you, yes. Right, Peter?
Exactly, because I'm wise.
Don't give this book to anybody without prefacing it by saying, which is actually a terrible take on everything.
This could very well just be satire.
It could be satire, but I have my doubts. We'll let people weigh in on social media as they are bound to. All right, Peter, what's on the website this week?
Hey, we've got a nice little special little piece on the Internet Medieval Sourcebook. It turns 25 this year. And so we talked with Paul Halsall, like, who kind of the founder and editor of it, why it came about and, you know, its kind of influence. And, you know, like, I have to say that I think this is probably the most important contribution to medieval studies in the last generation was this website that is hugely popular and has made a big difference for countless university and college classrooms. So we have that. And I think we're also going to have a piece on how well you know you're a Norse, the Norse language, using movie quotes.
That's brilliant. Why didn't I think of that? That's awesome. I love Thanks. That people in medieval studies have such a great sense of humor that they bring to their scholarship. It's awesome. We should probably mention that if you want to read how to tell if your 12th century lover is just not that into you, you can find that on medievalist.net as well.
Along with many, many of your fine articles.
Literally hundreds, I think.
Indeed, indeed.
All right. Well, thanks, Peter, for stopping by to talk about the art of courtly love.
Thanks.
Thank you to all of our patrons on patreon.com for your help keeping the Medieval Podcast going. It's your support that makes this possible, so all of it is most appreciated. Patrons can choose from all sorts of great stuff like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, membership in our book club, and our amazing maps by Tina Ross. To find out how to become a patron of the Medieval Podcast, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. Don't forget that the Medieval Masterclass for Creators starts up again for a new session beginning May 7th. This 6-week course is my baby, and together with my fellow instructors, I walk you through all sorts of everyday information from cooking to fighting to blacksmithing to help you bring your medieval fiction to life with those authentic details audiences crave. The class is starting to fill up, so to find out more and to book your spot, please visit medievalmasterclass.com. For everything from courtly love to court cases, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter @medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Sobolski, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5-Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books, including Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, at your favorite online bookstores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself a wonderful day.